Good afternoon. I'm Gilad Atzmon. I'm a jazz artist. I play tonight. We played here already for 2 days. We are playing for another 2 days. If you're not impressed with my thoughts, you can always give, give it a go and come to listen to our music. I can't decide what is better. This is why I do both. I write books and play fast and loud. It is a style that is known to be jazz. Anyway, we are going to talk about my new book, Being in Time, a Post-Political Manifesto. I forgot the title for a second. And I'll try to make it short. I'll speak for 40 minutes, and then we will have a Q&A. And then hopefully you will buy the entire stock. You know, this is the Jew in me. You know. You know. I left Judaism behind, but I still keep on marketing, you know, obviously. The post-political condition. What is it? Long time ago, but I think within your living memory, within our living memory, politicians claim to represent us, and we tended to believe that there were somehow kind of an extension of our whims, our wishes. And at a certain stage, this unique bond between us and our political system kind of evaporated, disappeared. At a certain stage, it became clear that we were reduced into consumers, and the politicians are doing very little except maintaining consumption. How they did it? By means of credit, because here in Germany, you still make some things, but like in England, in the USA, Belgium, you know, we are kind of parasite nations. We claim we produce nothing. For quite a while, we were buying with money we believed we had, but we didn't. And at a certain stage, it became clear that we were buying with money we never had. And this is the 2008 credit crunch. We have been impoverished for quite a while. We are poorer and poorer and poorer. And when I try to describe it in metaphorical terms, you know, our cities, the capital, the financial capitals, are suffocated now with all these beautiful glass towers. And when you look at them, it's always kind of for bankers and traders and big companies. And when you look at them, you think, oh, it's quite a nice idea that they made it out of glass because, you know, it's transparent. They have nothing to hide. But when you get close to these buildings, you realize that the glass is actually a mirror. You cannot see through. When you try to peep in into these buildings, all you see is yourself standing in the street in the cold. So for me, this book is about the condition of being left alone in the street. Now, you want to ask yourself a question. How is it possible that such a huge transition is taking place in our society and we don't know about it? Academia, silent. The media is silent. Nobody speaks about it. We don't understand what is going on. We kind of somehow feel that we are getting poorer by the minute. We know also that some people out there in Wall Street or in the city of London or Frankfurt are tripling their wealth once a month. By the way, is there anyone in the room who managed to triple his capital in the last month? It is very, very, it is very, very interesting. I started to look into it to try to understand this unique silence. And I realized that there were two elements that contributed to our disaster. Prime elements, I mean. One is political correctness. And we will talk about political correctness, but the idea that you cannot really say what you think. This is a very helpful method. We will extend the discussion about it in 10 or 15 minutes. But I would like to start with identity politics. The two elements that made us weak, unprepared, and to a certain extent, nations of zombies, intellectual zombies, are political correctness and identity politics. What is identity politics? When we were young, the left message was very simple. They promised to unite us all. They used to tell us it doesn't matter if you are black or Turkish or a Jew or a woman or a lesbian or a feminist. What is left? We're all together against the bad guys, the capital. I was young when I heard it for the first time, and I was quite excited because it is a universal message. We are all together against the bad guys. But then, pretty much out of the blue, the left adopted a completely new philosophy. Rather than uniting us all together, they started to break us into identities. They started to teach us to talk as a Jew, as a woman, as a lesbian, as a queer lesbian, as a feminist, as a Turk, as a Muslim. This is very strange. How come? What is most embarrassing about it, and we are talking now about what we call the new left, is that they've managed to adopt the most embarrassing aspect of Hitlerian thought. What is the problem with Hitler for most people? It's not the idea of national socialism. The idea of being a socialist is not that bad. Equality, a nationalist, still, it's not that bad. The idea of Italian fascism, equality of the Italian people, between the Italian people, is not a bad idea. The idea of German national socialism, equality between German-speaking people, this is not very problematic. What was the problem? The idea of equality of one race. And why? Because if you are born to the wrong race, you have a problem. The left was stupid enough, the new left, to adopt the idea of biological determinism. We are divided now by biology, by the color of your skin, by your sexual preference. We tend to believe that it's a biological thing. You want to call yourself a Jew? You are defined by the blood of your mother, politically? They really managed to adopt the most embarrassing aspect of Hitlerian philosophy. And the big question is why? How could the left fall into this embarrassing trap? I looked into it, and once again, I managed to put the finger on two prime elements, or two prime reasons. First, there is, within left thinking, within left traditional thinking, there is a deep animosity, hold your breath, to working people. Now, I'm saying something that is complete absurd, because the left supposed to work for the working people. Yes, ideally, this is the, in theory, this is true, but in practice, there is a bit of a battle there. And why? Because the working people never vote for the left. They vote Donald Trump, they vote for Le Pen. Believe it or not, we have a real socialist, real nice guy in London. Still British, in England, sorry. Still more than half of the British working people, if it's true, I'm just read demography analysis and I share it with you. Still, more than half of the British working people voted for Theresa May. There is an animosity between left and working people. And why? Very easy to explain. The left revolutionary come to a working man, his name is Franz, and he said, Franz, tomorrow at 12 o'clock, we start the revolution, we meet in the A train. And Franz said, no, I cannot do it. I'm at work till 5. Here is the secret. Working people are the people who go to work. They don't have time for this left masturbation. And on top of it, the left message is quite complicated. It's really, when you try to read Marx, it's very complicated. We are united, man, and the labor division, and we will change. Wow! If you're right wing, all you need is a flag. A fucking flag. I said it to the camera, you know, so they can't tell. A fucking flag. If I adhere to the British flag, Newton becomes my cousin, Churchill becomes my grandfather. I would like to be, Rolls-Royce becomes my, I couldn't afford it, but we make it just down the road. The same applies to America. What the left offers you instead? A leaflet? A cardboard? A picket? Regardless of the message of the left, it's a complicated message, and it doesn't appeal to the working people, and it never did. And the first person to understood it was Gramsci. You heard about Gramsci?
Yes.
Good. You know, Gramsci realized that the revolution, as we understood it at the time, wasn't going to happen. In order to introduce a change, we have to be slightly more sophisticated. We have to change things in a cultural manner. And this is the transition between traditional Marxism that speaks about the shift in labor division and so on, into cultural Marxism, where we understand that in order to change things, we have to change the way people think. Whether you like it or not, the most influential school of thought of cultural Marxists was in this country, not in this town actually, in Frankfurt, and we are talking about the Frankfurt School. You heard about the Frankfurt School? Adorno, Marcuse, Erich Fromm, Horkheimer, and it wasn't part of the Frankfurt School, but still very, very influential, especially in America, Wilhelm Reich. They were very upset by the rise of Hitler. Wilhelm Reich said, how is it possible that we offer them a revolution and they still don't go with us? He had the answer. It is because the German people, he believed, were sexually oppressed. I assume that he didn't watch German porn. Which I did, by the way, once. It was enough. Everything was there. I could say, sorry, it's a camera. I'm not there. yeah. It was an orchestrated attack on the patriarchal family, on the church, on every value that sustained this culture. Anyway, 33, they had to run away. We asked ourselves 5 minutes ago, how is it possible that these changes took place without us understanding? We can now start to understand. The left had a problem with working class being united, because working class being united means that they vote for Hitler. It means that they vote for Trump. It means that they vote for Theresa May. It means that they vote for Le Pen. The left decided or fall into this trap. They started to divide, to break the working class into identitarian groups. We created a network of cosmopolitan tribes. The tribes of the lesbian, the tribes of the black, the tribes of the Jews. In practice, everyone became a Jew. Because we are all operating within this cosmopolitan format. And I'll show you how it works. Let's say that we have a problem with Russia. We always have a problem with Russia. You know about it, you remember. What do we do? We have a gay lobby. The gay identity doesn't end in the German border. It continues to Poland. It continued to Czech Republic. It continued to Belgium. It continued to Belarus. It continued to Russia. It continued to Moscow. We use the gay lobby to pressure Putin. And this is exactly how the Jewish lobby is working. It's an international lobby. This bond between the new left and the Jewish intelligentsia, a la Frankfurt School, Wilhelm Reich, contributed to the rise of this identity politics. Now, why did they do it? Was it a conspiracy? I don't know. I don't believe in conspiracies. By the way, this is very important. There are no Jewish conspiracies. Have you ever heard? There are no Jewish conspiracies. Jews do everything in the open. Everything. You just cannot talk about it. This is the trick, okay? This is the trick. And this is very, very important. And we will deal with it in a second once we start to tackle political correctness. The same applies to identity politics. It is done in the open. In America, in Britain, I don't know about gay marriage here. What the fuck? I don't give a shit about gay marriage. It's none of my business. It's really none of my business. They can do whatever they want. Instead of dealing in our political world with the most important thing, which are education, health, and most important, manufacturing. What is manufacturing? Manufacturing means that you have a reason to wake up tomorrow morning at 7 to go to work. Something that we don't have anymore in Britain or in America or in most of the Western countries because everyone, you took everything. I appreciate it. You know, I'm not complaining here. Instead of talking about production, about health, about education, the idea that our kids, we think that our kids will fulfill their potential, we talk about gay marriage? Now we have a huge crisis in Britain. A huge crisis. The government is about to form a coalition with the DUP, which are Irish Nationalist Unionist. The Irish the peace process is about to collapse. And what do we talk about? About LGBT. As if it's a problem. It's not a problem. If it will be a problem, we will talk about it. I tell you, I'm queer lesbian. I care about it. We broke society into identity groups, and as a unity of people, Germans, Brits, Belgians, Americans, Canadian, Austrian, Japanese, we lost our ability to resist, because even if we resist, we start to fight against each other. The black against the rednecks, the feminist against the male chauvinist, it's all kind of sectarian wars that doesn't help us to rescue our situation. All that is happening in front of our eyes, and nobody is saying a thing. The academia, with all the money that they get, they don't really warn us. The press, the television, they don't see what is going on? Good question. The reason that we were subject to such an intensive, brutal rape, all of us, is because of the tyranny of correctness. What is the tyranny of correctness? What is political correctness? Political correctness is politics that doesn't allow political opposition. Now you realize that politics that doesn't allow political opposition is the definition of tyranny. But let me tell you, political correctness is way more dangerous than tyranny. And why? Because in the case of tyranny, you oppose an external entity. Your oppressor, whether it is a tyrant or regime or a government, is exterior to yourself. It could be the Communist Party, it could be Hitler, Stalin. In the case of political correctness, it is you. Each of us becomes a self-oppressing tyrant. The way they do it, they plant something like a computer virus, like a Trojan horse in your brain. Once you really want to say something, you see a beautiful woman, blonde, and I cannot even say it, you know, I just And once you feel that you cannot really express yourself, it's kind of a pain. Because I'm really, yeah. Next time, you will stop yourself from thinking about it. And there is no third time. There is no third time because you turn into a complete zombie. You learn to suppress your intuitions, your thoughts, your desires, your whims, your wishes. We are living in a free society and we are the most oppressed people in the history of humanity. We are a bunch of castrated morons. Different places. We have some Americans here. I toured in America, and when I had to explain how it happened, I went back to Archie Bunker. Do you remember Archie Bunker? And anyone? Did you have Archie Bunker in Germany? All in the family?
Yeah.
Apparently, I learned today that you had another German, a German kind of a copy of All in the Family. Now, it wasn't a big success. You know why? Because you didn't need it. You didn't need it. You had the Holocaust. Holocaust is a question system. It has the same impact. Once there are people bring the Holocaust, everybody knows what he can say, what he cannot say. It is a silencing mechanism. In different places, it takes different shape. Holocaust is there to tell us what is right, what is wrong, what is correct, what is not correct, what we should never ask. And by the way, if you want to liberate yourself, when it comes to America, you go back to Archie Bunker. If you want to liberate yourself in Germany, you go back to the Holocaust and you ask yourself, why is it such an oppressive intellectual texture? Why is it that I cannot really rewrite my past or look into it? And I hope that we'll get into it in the Q&A because it's a very, very interesting topic, and I have to be very careful the way I handle this topic in Germany because you have some laws in Germany that do not allow you laws that do not allow you to explore this topic in the most frank manner. So we have to be careful, but I'm sure that we can do it. The more I looked into these issues, I came to a conclusion that what we really see is a colossal battle between Athens and Jerusalem. What is this battle between Athens and Jerusalem? Athens is the city of philosophy. Athens is where we think things through. Athens is where science is born. Athens is where aesthetic is born. Beauty. I would like to think that everything that we really like about our Western universe comes from Athens. Jerusalem is the city of revelation. Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments is the complete opposite of ethics. Ten Commandments are not ethical. It's the opposite of ethics. Don't kill. I don't need you to tell me not to kill. I hope. Don't steal. I don't need you to tell me not to steal. I know that it's not ethical. I understand it. In Jerusalem, there is no ethics. By the way, Jerusalem is not Jews, yeah? When you talk about Jerusalem, Tony Blair is a Jerusalemite. Theresa May is a Jerusalemite. Hillary Clinton is a Jerusalemite. They're not Jews. They're Jerusalemite. A lot of institutions now think in Jerusalemite terms. Look what happened in London. The Athenians say, look what we have done. We took all our poor people, we put them in a tower, we covered them with inflammable cladding, and look what happened. It was a massacre. What did Jerusalem might say? Oh, we have to check whether it was according to regulation. It's not important. It's not about regulation. It's about ethics. It's not about 10 commandments that they tell you what cladding to put on what building. No. The problem that we have, and now I try to put everything together, is that the left is a Jerusalemite concept. Maybe Marx was Athenian, or partially Athenian. But the left always turn into a dogma. What is right, what is wrong, what to do, what not to do. The left is always 10 commandments. The progressives. If I'm telling you that I'm progressive, it means that I think that some other people are reactionary. This is exactly a repetition of the Jew and the Goy. The Jew, the chosen, and the Goy. The progressive and the reactionary. At the time, Corbyn was campaigning for working people in Britain, I saw so many of his supporters talking down so much on the working people because they are chosen knights. This is the issue. They don't argue. When Hillary Clinton had a problem with some Trump supporters, they became the deplorables, rednecks, the left, the progressive, look down at rednecks. You are American. Rednecks are people who have their neck red because they were walking in the field. The left look down at the people who walk in the fields. It means that the left is even detached from its own discourse. And I came to a very frightening conclusion. The dystopia in which we live is all due to the fact that for too many years we have been living under the helm of Jerusalem. We forgot about Athens. We forgot about ethics, how to think things through. And the only way to save our universe at this stage is to bring Athens back. Now, it's quite pathetic that a person who was born in Jerusalem is talking about bringing Athens back. But it's not the first time. Along the history of the Jews, we had a few self-haters that managed to to point at this necessary transition. For me, history is the ability to narrate the past as we move along. So as we proceed in time, we look back and things may look differently because we become more and more clever or less clever. We change. I'll give you a beautiful example. Are there any Palestinian supporters in the room?
Palestinian supporters?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Have you heard about the Nakba? Okay, not many people know about the Nakba. The Nakba is an event that happened in 1948. The Israelis ethnically cleansed the vast majority of the Palestinians. But nobody spoke about the Nakba or knew what it was, except a few Palestinians who were subject to this horrific event, until the 80s. Nobody spoke about it. In the late 80s, everybody started to talk about the Nakba, and it became a major event. And why? At the time of the conflict in Kosovo, some Israeli new historians, including Palestinian ones like Numa Salha, started to realize that what was happening in Kosovo, the ethnic cleansing, this notion that started to be discussed widely, is exact reflection of what happened in 48. So we have a new notion, namely ethnic cleansing, and we look back, oh my God, the Nakba was also ethnic cleansing. So we proceed in time, and it helps us to understand the notion of the past. There is a very famous American historian, Timothy Snyder. Anyone heard about him? In his last book, Black Earth, and he's a Holocaust traditionalist, and he's definitely not a revisionist, mainstream historian, but he developed a very interesting theory. He argues that what happened in World War II can be explained now. Countries that were stripped of sovereignty are exactly the same places where we see genocide. So in the East, in Poland, in parts of Russia, Belarus, this is where we see genocide at the time of the war. In France, in Belgium, in Holland, we don't have genocides. Why? Because these countries maintain kind of an institutional sovereign status, but under occupation, under German occupation. This is interesting. And then he says something that is even more interesting. Look at us. We learned nothing, or in proper English, fuck all. We didn't learn the most important lesson from World War II. This is what we did in Iraq, Syria, Libya. We destroyed this country, their sovereignty, and what we come out, what we witness, a massacre, a genocide. And this is exactly the unique ability to understand the history as we move along, to understand the past, as we move along, and this gives us a new ability to prevent us from making the same mistakes in the future. If we would understand what Timothy Snyder understood now, 10 years ago, we wouldn't have a massacre in Syria. We wouldn't have a genocide in Libya. But you cannot do it because you are not allowed to look freely at your past, because if you do that, you may start to ask questions that will infringe your will lead to an infringement of your freedom. And this is a very dangerous thing. And this is exactly how political correctness works in Germany. It comes to the past, you're all paralyzed. It's not just the European, it's like this is exactly the Jerusalemite way of thinking. If we are not entitled or not allowed or not a proper discussion is not facilitated, we don't examine our politics in a broad and ethical manner. We have a fixed idea what is right and what is wrong, who is right and who is wrong, who we are allowed to talk to, who we are not allowed to talk to. Somebody says thing that you don't agree with, it becomes a conspiracy theorist, a white supremacist, a Nazi. We have a list of titles that kill the ability to exchange. Now, this is exactly the kosher doctrine, the kosher, you know, like from Jewish kosher doctrine. We have a clear idea of what is kosher and what isn't. Jewish history is a very sophisticated system that is there to conceal the fact that wherever Jews go, sooner or later, there will be a disaster. This is Jewish history. There is nothing, you know, Jews always say, listen, we kicked out, we suffered. You suffer for a reason. History, Jewish history, is the art of making the Jews blind to their cultural system. By the way, just shortly, Zionism, early Zionism, was a unique moment in Jewish history. They say, oh my God, we are not nice people, actually. We have to do something about it. We'll go to Zion, and rather than being bunkers, we will start to work. Zionism was a promise to civilize the Jews, to amend their catastrophic history. And by the way, they went to Zion, they went to Palestine, and they started to work. They worked hard for a week. And then they found out that the Palestinians were slightly cheaper. And this was the end of the Zionist dream. American history, it's true. It's true. Zionism was a beautiful thing for a week or two. By the way, some Zionists are still beautiful people, like Uri Avneri, Gideon Levy, those who are interested in this discourse. They still believe in this dream. It's beautiful. American history, they have a lot to cover. Slavery, racism. There wasn't a single year in the 20th century without American dropping bombs on civilians somewhere in the world. You know, so there is this democratic thing, and we bring democracy. Whoa! Yeah? Japanese history. Because I had to give this talk in Japan. They conceal everything. You know? And German history, you have a big problem. I tell you, what is your problem? I never lived in Germany, but I walked here a lot. And don't kind of be flattered and start to be arrogant and to prove me wrong, but you are, I'm a bit emotional when I think about it, the most beautiful people on this planet. You are beautiful people. It's always great experience to be here, to play here, to have a discussion. We are having fun. And you have to conceal from yourself the fact that you are such a great people. So you have this kind of holocaust, zoom, diving. French? I don't know. I'd have to think. Probably when I was in France, I told them the same thing, that they're the most beautiful people. You know, it always works. It always works. No. what is it about France? Well, I just think about it now, yeah? Are you French?
No.
Good, good, because it, you know, if you were, it would be a problem. But French people, they're very nationalist, very proud, very militant, but they're not good soldiers. You know, so there is history, you know, so it's a bit of a problem, you know, it's always end up with a catastrophe, you know, but because, for instance, you also lost the war, but nobody doubts the fact, but it was a fucking moronic war. You went like me against all of you. You know, I managed to pull some punches, you know, but you'll knock me down, you know. Anyway, hey, I think that I'm here still. I'll be with you and you can ask me questions. And are you staying for the concert? You should, because it's the same thing, but with no lyrics, you know, the same temperament. And what you can do now, which will be very helpful, because if not, it will be slightly pathetic. You can buy the book or the CD or the book and the CD or. You can buy also the bass, the double bass. No, sell that. No, it's not for sale. All right. So feel free. I'll Naima, can you help me here? Thank you so much.